streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I'm here in New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm here today to discuss Smugglers, Pirates, and Patriots, Free Trade in the Age of Revolution, published earlier this year by University of Pennsylvania Press. The author is Tyson Reeder. He's an editor at the James Madison Papers and an affiliated assistant professor at the University of Virginia. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Reeder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Ryan.
So before we dive into the questions, let's talk a little bit about your cover here. There's several images. How did you assemble this striking cover?
With a lot more work than I care to admit. What I wanted to give readers a sense of before they even picked up the book, I wanted to give them a sense of really what sort of an Atlantic history this book was, how it integrated widespread regions of the Atlantic from Europe to North America to Brazil to Africa. And I wanted to, sort of give them an idea of some of the tumultuous episodes that we talk about in the book and that are discussed in the book. So in terms of the American Revolution and its effect on free trade ideology in North America, in terms of revolutions and wars in Brazil, piracy, North American pirates who went and preyed on Portuguese ships in Brazil, smugglers, all of these tumultuous things. I wanted to give readers a sort of sense of what they could expect when they picked up the book. And as I mentioned, particularly the Atlantic dimensions of the book. This goes beyond the British Atlantic. It goes beyond early American history, but that the book really does integrate regions from all around the Atlantic into a coherent narrative.
So during the 17th and 18th centuries, how did British commercial networks come to dominate Portuguese commerce in Brazil and the Luso-Atlantic before and after the 1766 prohibition on English grain exports? In addition, after the 1755 Lisbon earthquake, how did the Marquis of Pombal inadvertently strengthen Portugal's ties to British America? In your response, if you can, please address at least three of the following: the 1703 Methven Treaty, the relaxation of British mercantilism, British Atlantic demand for gold, the slave trade, the British American slave trade, and that mid-Atlantic Madeira wine trade.
Yeah, so these are all sorts of widespread, far-flung areas of the Atlantic that really ended up with intricate ties. So I think the best place to start would be treaties between Portugal and England. And so this would bring us to the 1640s, particularly in 1642. The Portugal had been unified politically with Spain for a long time. Portugal was now trying to assert its independence from Spain. And so it was in a very precarious situation. And so it began to make treaties with England, where England would essentially give them military protection in return for advantageous economic benefits for England. And so in 1642, they signed one of these treaties. In 1654, they signed another treaty that prohibited the Portuguese from raising duties on English manufacturers above 23% of the value of the goods. And then it's really capped off with the Methuen Treaty of 1703. And that allows English woolens to enter Lisbon and Porto free of duty, which is a great boon, for, of course, for English manufacturers. And it also reduces wines on Portuguese, or it reduces duties on Portuguese wines that entered England. But it's an obviously more advantageous treaty to the English than it is to Portugal, and really stems from Portugal's weak bargaining position with England. And so early on, they began to really strengthen their economic ties and strengthen an alliance between Portugal and England. But more than an alliance, it was really a sort of economic subservience of Portugal to England. And that spills over into Portugal's relationship with British America. British Americans enjoyed some of these advantages, and especially they enjoyed the advantage of the Madeira wine trade. The Madeira wine trade became very important to British America because due to these treaties and the close economic relationship between Britain or between England and Portugal, England actually exempted Madeira wine. Madeira is a small island in the middle of the Atlantic, but it produced a lot of wine. And because Madeira wine was exempted from the Navigation Acts by the English, then Americans, English colonists in the Americas began to import a lot of Madeira wine. Madeira wine didn't have to pass through London like other wines did, or other imports into British America. And so it really tightens the relationship, the economic relationship between British America and, between British America, Great Britain, and Portugal. And a lot of other things go into this, though. Such as the gold trade and the slave trade between Brazil and Africa. And so in 1695, gold is discovered in the regions, in the outer regions of São Paulo in Brazil. And this starts to revive Portugal's empire to an extent that had really been waning since the 1400s. And so, the 14 and 1500s, I should say. And so with the beginning of this revival, Portugal wants to begin to import gold from Brazil, and so they have an incentive to increase slavery in Brazil so that they can produce more gold, so the slaves are working in Brazilian mines, sending gold back to Portugal. And that becomes important because Portugal is importing so many manufacturers from England, they need some way to pay for that. And the way that they pay for that is by smuggling gold from Portugal to England. That gold wasn't legally supposed to leave Portugal, but it did, and then left it in droves. And so one thing that they paid for with that gold was provisions that they received from British America. So British Americans, especially in Pennsylvania, New York, and Maryland, are sending a lot of wheat, flour, breadstuff, and other provisions to Portugal. And Portugal is really dependent for a long time on foreign sources of provisions. And so they pay for those by sending gold to Britain to pay British American creditors in England. And so all of this is to say that what seems like a pretty straightforward relationship where British Americans were importing wine from Portugal and exporting provisions to Portugal actually came surrounded with an entire Atlantic backdrop of slavery, of gold trade, of smuggling in Africa, in Europe, and in North America and South America. So early on, we begin to see the real Atlantic dimensions of this story.
So let's go into a little more context. Can you explain how proponents of the Enlightenment promulgated what you describe as free trade ideology in natural law and natural rights?
Yeah. So early theorists, theorists for a long time had promulgated some form of economic freedom. And we can go clear back to 1609 to the Dutch jurist, Huig de Groot. His name is frequently Latinized as Hugo Grotius. In 1609, he publishes Mare Liberum, which means the free sea. And he makes one of the earliest strong ideological defenses of free trade. And in Grotius's idea, he assumes that the creator had created the oceans to connect people, not to divide them. And so he creates a sort of natural law ideology about free trade, or I guess we'd call it a proto-natural law, that free trade should be natural between empires. And he's followed up by a number of philosophers, from David Hume to Adam Smith to Ange Godard to Jacques-Claude Marie Vincent de Bonnet, all of whom begin to advocate some sort of free trade. And they suggest that empires should not depend on secrecy, on having closed empires, but that they should be marked by cooperation and by mutual interest. And so as they continue to develop a sort of natural law ideology around free trade, that begins to spill over into concepts of smuggling and theories about smuggling. And so, for instance, if free trade is a natural law, then restrictions on that natural law justify violations of that natural law or violations of political laws. And so, for instance, in France or in Great Britain, we see a lot of people begin to smuggle and justify their smuggling. And in British America, they begin to justify their smuggling essentially by saying, this is a natural law. The government is disobeying this natural law. And so we are simply obeying the natural law by violating our political laws.
What role did British debates over political economy in the American Revolution, in addition to the Portuguese slave trade, reduced gold production, and Brazilian contraband investment, what role did they all play in the weakening of Lisbon control of the Luso Atlantic?
Yeah, so I think if you start with the American Revolution, well, the American Revolution was really based on debates. Well, it was based in large part on debates over British political economy. And so as American colonists began to rebel and then eventually revolutionize against the imperial economic nexus of the British Atlantic, it has a strong effect because of their close ties. It has a strong effect on Portugal. And so the British begin, really with the Sugar Act in 1764, the British begin to make more stringent laws against trade with Portugal, even against trade with Madeira, which had been left alone, which had been exempted from the Navigation Acts for a long time. And they begin to clamp down on illicit trade with Portugal, and illicit trade, direct trade between British America and Portugal. And so early on, the Portuguese trade, the British American Portuguese trade starts to suffer due to the constitutional crisis between British America and Great Britain. And as the American Revolution unfolds, in large part, Americans are rebelling for their right to save their economic networks that they have worked out over the last century. And yet at the same time, to assert that right, they start to put their own restrictions on those very networks that they're trying to save. So, for instance, in 1774, they signed the Articles of Association that is supposed to boycott Madeira wine because Madeira wine was beginning to be seen as a way of, or a means of the British to subjugate their colonists because the British are now taxing and placing duties, stringent duties on Madeira wine. And so they boycott those items. And so they're actually severing their ties with Portugal, paradoxically, even as they're rebelling to save those very network, those very economic networks that they had built up over the last century. And that also has those ties are also being weakened by Portuguese actions. And so during the American Revolution, for example, the Marquis of Pombal begins to embargo imports of provisions from America because he's trying to finesse his relationship with Great Britain and his alliance with Great Britain. He at this time, Pombal has a lot of competing interests, but in the end, he essentially is going to come down on the side of Great Britain. Portugal is officially neutral during the American Revolution, but in a sort of gesture of goodwill, Pombal does, in a gesture of goodwill toward Great Britain, Pombal does embargo. He embargoes British American goods that are coming to Portugal. And so the American Revolution has a very negative impact on British American and Portuguese trade.
As a follow-up, just to specifically, how did the specifically the 1764 Sugar Act imperil British American trade with Portugal and complicate smuggling? And then can you also address the Restraining Act?
Yeah, so the Sugar Act, as I said, it's really the first time in a long time that Portugal has done anything to restrict trade between the Portuguese Empire and British America. And what the 1764 Sugar Act is going to do is place duties on Madeira wine, and that becomes a problem not only for for British American trade with Madeira, but it also becomes a problem for British American trade with Portugal itself and with Lisbon, because smugglers in British America had long made a habit of bringing Lisbon wines, which were not exempted from the Navigation Acts, they bring them to Madeira and switch them the cargoes that they were carried in, and basically repackaged Lisbon wine as Madeira wine, because Madeira wine did not have duties placed on it and was not subject to the Navigation Acts. And so there was a large smuggling network between Lisbon and British America, and Madeira kind of served as the middle person where you could switch out Lisbon wines for Madeira wines and carry Lisbon wines under cover of Madeira wines into British America. And so when Madeira wines start to be onerously taxed under the Sugar Act, it sort of ruins those smuggling networks and it ruins trade with Madeira. And so it has a particularly negative effect on British American trade with the Portuguese Empire. British Americans begin to, like I said, in 1774, they incorporate Madeira wine into their list of goods that they're going to boycott under the Articles of Association, which was a large swath of items that they were going to boycott from the British Empire. But because Madeira wine was so wrapped up in British trade, a lot of British merchants are in Madeira. In fact, almost all wine exporters, major wine exporters, are actually British Madeirans rather than Madeirans, native Madeirans, or Portuguese Madeirans. And so Madeira gets wrapped into these Articles of Association, as part of a colonial protest. And by 1775, the British, after the colonists say, we are going to boycott British goods, the British essentially say, well, if you're not going to trade with us, you're not going to trade with anybody. And in 1775, they pass the Restraining Acts, and they begin to really clamp down on trade, British-American trade, inter-imperial trade, on smuggling. They step up their patrol. British men of war step up their patrol of smuggling. And so it begins to make it very difficult. Americans for a long time had depended on smuggling to continue on their trade with the Portuguese Empire, whether it was from Portugal and in a lot of cases with Brazil. American smugglers had made their way to Brazil and tried to import Brazilian sugars and, with any luck, Brazilian gold into British America. But as men of war patrols tightened, really beginning in the mid-1770s, that becomes harder and harder to maintain those smuggling networks for British Americans. And so they find it more difficult to carry on either legal trade or illegal trade with the Portuguese Empire.
So on that note, to elaborate, why did Portugal focus then on domestic production after the war, the Revolutionary War? And what were the consequences of a decline in U.S. Madeira consumption and Portuguese trade restrictions on the U.S. provisioning trade?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, I briefly mentioned the Marquis of Pombal. Let me go a little bit further into his history to really help us understand why Portugal is, by the end of the Revolutionary War, was beginning to prohibit or wanted to prohibit U.S. provisions, now U.S. provisions, from entering Portugal. The Marquis de Pombal, as he's known, came to power with the Lisbon earthquake in 1755. The Lisbon earthquake was an incredibly powerful earthquake, an incredibly destructive earthquake, just off the coast of Lisbon in the Tagus, in the River Tagus. And it caused seismic waves that destroyed Lisbon. Buildings crumbled, cathedrals crumbled, killed parishioners. This was on All Saints' Day in 1755. A lot of people are at church and buildings and these heavy stone-built churches come crumbling down, kill thousands of people. Fires begin to escape hearths. The wind picks up and spreads the fires. I mean, the earthquake was essentially an Aristotelian nightmare, where earth, wind, fire, and water really combined to destroy Lisbon. And Pombal is the first minister under Dom José, who was the king of Portugal at the time. And Pombal uses the opportunity. José really wanted nothing to do with trying to rebuild Lisbon. José seems to have been terror-struck by the earthquake in a lot of ways. And he wasn't a very effective leader before the earthquake hit anyway. And so Pombal really uses the opportunity to seize the reins of government from the king and begin to implement his own idea of what a Portuguese economy should look like. And so after 1755, the Portuguese government really is beginning to try to separate itself from its ties, its strong ties to Britain, not sever them completely, but Pombal really wants to weaken the ties, the stranglehold that he feels Britain has on Portuguese commerce. Now, he's effective to some degree, but what he really does is, as he makes it more difficult for British manufacturers to send their goods to Portugal, they begin to look elsewhere. And one of the places that they look is British America. In the beginning of the 1750s and 1760s, we see British Americans really ramp up the number of imports that they're receiving from Great Britain. And that's spurred at least in part by the Marquis of Pombal trying to make it more difficult for the British to send their imports to Portugal. And yet, at the same time, Pombal inadvertently, even as he weakened ties with Great Britain, he inadvertently strengthened ties with the British, with British America. Because as British Americans begin to import more British goods, as partly as a result of Pombal's policies, as they begin to import more British goods, they need some way to pay for them. And they pay for them by stepping up their exports, their provisions exports, to Portugal. And so he inadvertently strengthens his ties with British America. And he inadvertently only makes Portugal more dependent on British America for its provisions. And so he begins to, that's part of the calculation when he decides to cut off American imports into Portugal. It's a good opportunity, as British Americans are cutting ties with the British government, it's a good opportunity for him to say, oh, okay, look, Great Britain, we're on your side. We're going to cut ties with British America as well in terms of economic ties. And that will give Portugal the chance to step up its domestic production. He wants to start growing wheat. He wants to start producing flour mills so that they can grind their own wheat into flour. And this becomes somewhat of a national project beginning in the 1770s. So in the 1780s, by the end of the American Revolution, British Americans look at this situation, look at the Portuguese embargo against their provisions, and they say, well, look, this is, you know, with the end of the revolution, we should be able to persuade Portugal, now that we're an independent country, to begin allowing our provisions. You know, we're not rebellious colonies anymore. It won't offend the British anymore if he allows us to send our goods to Portugal again. So hopefully we'll start having flour, sending flour and rice and wheat in large quantities to Portugal once again, just like we did before the revolution. But by this time, Pombal is out of power, and Maria the First is ascended to the throne. But she still has different ideas from the Americans, and essentially the Portuguese want to continue on this project of domestic production of their own provisions, and so they continue to prohibit American wheat and flour and other provisions from entering Portugal. And so the American Revolution didn't just sever ties. Americans kind of conceived that it was just going to sever ties for a short time during the revolution itself. And after a successful revolution, they picked those ties back up where they left off. But that didn't happen. The Portuguese had really no incentive to start importing a lot of goods from the United States again, and become dependent once again on American provisions.
So let's shift to the 1790s and the early 1800s. Well, actually, before we do that, though, during the 1790s, how did U.S. free trade advocates combine elements of British Whig tradition and Enlightenment-era political economy to cast smuggling, republicanism, and free trade as what you describe as complementary components of the same liberal ideology?
Yeah, so in part of their justification for ramping up their smuggling in the 1760s, as Britain was trying to impose more economic restrictions on the colonies, Americans made good use of Enlightenment ideology to suggest that they had a natural right to free trade. They had a natural right to not have these restrictions, these economic restrictions that Great Britain was trying to place on them. And so in North America, they began to conceive of a tidy syllogism where they equated independence from Europe with republicanism, and republicanism with free trade, and free trade with prosperity. And so they began to, and it was always a bit of a myth, but they began to assume that republics would become the protectors of natural law, including the natural law of free trade, versus empires and monarchies that imposed mercantilism and economic restrictions on peoples. And so they looked, Americans early on looked at republicanism as an answer to European mercantilism. And of course, European mercantilism had never gone uncontested. It was always contested, including in Europe and in governments, in European governments themselves. But Americans begin to draw this tidy sort of simplistic equation of republics with free trade and European monarchies with mercantilism. And so they begin to, they assume that smuggling is just a part of that culture because any sort of restriction against trade can be legitimately violated to uphold natural law. In fact, I think Fisher Raines, a representative from Massachusetts, said it best when he suggested that the, in his words, he said something to the effect of, "The habit of smuggling pervades our country. We were taught it when it was considered meritorious rather than criminal," suggesting that during the Revolution, smuggling had been seen as a benefit. It had been seen as, in his word, to use his word, meritorious rather than a crime. And so they look at smuggling as a sort of republican answer to unnatural restrictions on trade by monarchies. And this gets wrapped into the idea also of revolution, that that republicanism has to be implemented in order to have free trade. And so you either need to smuggle or you need to have a republican revolution if you're going to have free trade. And so they apply that to their own experience during the American Revolution. And as they think back on the American Revolution, they think of their experience of smuggling as a sort of a heroic deed, as a heroic protest against British restrictions. And so moving forward, as they look at European colonies in South America and in the Caribbean, they continue that ideology forward, essentially saying, now either these colonies have to have republican revolutions for us to trade freely with these colonies, or we need to go ahead and just violate political laws, uphold natural law, and smuggle in these colonies, including, of course, Brazil.
Please elucidate the formation and significance of underground free trade cabals in Brazil, as well as Portuguese liberal reform and magistrate refusal to, quote, equate free trade with republicanism. The magistrates tolerated more open commerce only insofar as it benefited government coffers. In your elucidation, if you can, please address the role of Thomas Jefferson, the minus treachery, as well as contraband and U.S. smuggling.
Sure. So in North America, as I said, they begin to have this ideology as they look south, and they look to South American colonies that they've coveted for a long time. As I mentioned, some North Americans tried to go to Brazil to smuggle with Brazilians when they were still part of the British Empire. And so they've had their eyes on South America for a long time, and particularly Brazil. Brazil is beginning by the 1790s to be seen as the major prize of the Portuguese Empire, and that Portugal really is sort of meaningless without Brazil. And not only the Brazilian gold that has been coming from the colony, but also Brazilian sugar, especially, and coffee and other agricultural exports that begin to really take off in the 1790s. And so they look at Brazil really with a covetous eye. And as I said, the assumption is that the Brazilians either need to revolutionize or Americans will just go ahead and smuggle with Brazil. And by the end of the 1780s, really both methods seem feasible, because Brazilians Just as Americans wanted freer trade with Brazil, Brazilians wanted freer trade with the world. And they clamored for freer trade with the Portuguese monarchy. And there had been some give and take there over the years. And the Portuguese monarchy had conceded some items that Brazilian traders wanted. But Brazilians still looked to enhance their free trade with the world by the 1780s. And what we begin to see in the 1780s are some of these sort of underground cabals. We see people beginning to discuss clandestinely Enlightenment ideology. Some Brazilian revolutionaries start to study the American Articles of Confederation and state constitutions in the mid-1780s. And this starts to make itself manifest, I guess I should say, when some Brazilian revolutionaries reached out to Thomas Jefferson when he was an ambassador in France. And Jefferson started to receive very interesting correspondence from a Brazilian who wrote under the pseudonym of Vendek, not wanting to reveal himself in his writings. But he asked Jefferson for a secret meeting while Jefferson was in France, because Vendek at this time was also studying in France, even though he hailed from Rio de Janeiro. And so Jefferson and Vendek, as he's known at this time to Jefferson, they arrange a secret meeting in France. And it's sort of an indication of Jefferson's interest that on a trip to southern France, he went pretty well out of his way to meet this mysterious correspondent in Nîmes. And he went to Nîmes, Jefferson said, under the pretext of seeing the antiquities of the place, even though he went to have this secret meeting. And in that secret meeting, he met a young revolutionary in ill health named José Joaquim Mayai Barbado, who revealed himself as Vendek. And so Mayai Barbado begins to expound his thoughts to Jefferson about how the Brazilians can have a successful revolution. He says that the Portuguese military that's stationed in Brazil was really listless. They were slovenly. They wouldn't put up much of a fight in the case of a revolution. He very optimistically suggested that slaves would throw their lots in with their masters, which, of course, borders on optimism to the point of mythicism, but he tries to lay out this compelling case for a successful revolution in Brazil. Well, at the time, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, as ambassadors in Europe, had been trying to hammer out some sort of trade agreement with Portugal, and Portugal had not only refused Americans' entrance into Brazil, but Adams and Jefferson by this point, by 1786, had realized that Portugal was not going to reopen its borders to American provisions. And so the idea of a Brazilian revolution becomes very interesting to Jefferson, where essentially if Americans can't get into Brazil by a trade agreement with the Portuguese monarchy, perhaps they can get into Brazil after a Republican revolution occurs there. So the date is very interesting, 1786, when he has this discussion with this potential Brazilian revolutionary, because this is still 3 years before the outbreak of the French Revolution. So really, Jefferson's first interaction with a people who are looking to throw off the chains of monarchy, as he saw it, and institute a republican in this new world order, were Brazilians rather than the French, which, as I mentioned, wouldn't come along until a few years later. And so Jefferson is intrigued in 1786 by these overtures from Brazilians. Now, he did say that they were still hoping to cultivate good relations with Portugal. And he told Mayai Barbado during this meeting that, well, I'm not really speaking as a U.S. representative right now, but as a private individual, I can say that, in his words, a successful revolution in Brazil would not be uninteresting to us. So in some ways, he sort of gave Mayai Barbado a non-answer. But he did leave the meeting very intrigued with this possibility of the Brazilian Revolution, and he writes to the Secretary of Foreign Affairs at the time, John Jay, and informs John Jay about this meeting, explains some of the things that they talked about, and again says that, well, I understand that we're probably not going to aid Brazilian revolutionaries, we're in no position to do that, but we should keep our eye on developments there because they could become very interesting. And indeed they do, and especially in 1788, there's a small conspiracy, unsuccessful conspiracy, but still a conspiracy that in a lot of ways rattled the Portuguese monarchy. A small group of plotters, again, who had looked at who had studied closely the American Articles of Confederation, state constitutions, and things of that sort, began to plot an independence movement in the Brazilian province of Minas Gerais, which was the major gold-producing province of Brazil. And so these plotters, they expect, and indeed Portugal was planning on throwing on them an additional tax, a poll tax or a head tax in 1788. And so when these Minas conspirators hear about this tax, it's called the Rama, that the Portuguese Empire is going to place on Brazilians, they begin to make their move for Brazilian independence. They concoct a plan. A lieutenant in the military named Tiradentes is going to, again, according to their plan, to decapitate the governor. Another conspirator who is also in the military will command his troops to stand down. He'll demand of the people what they desire, at which point Tiradentes would raise the bloodied head of the governor and demand the liberty of the people, and a revolution would ensue among the people. Well, like all great plans, this planned revolution was foiled by internal treachery. One of the conspirators had betrayed his fellow conspirators. He denounced the plot to the governor, and Tiradentes ended up being hanged and quartered. And especially during the trials of these conspirators, it did rattle the Portuguese government, because the conspirators made very clear in their testimonies that they had drawn on ideas of the American Revolution, and that in a lot of ways they did look at the American Revolution as a sort of inspiration for what they were trying to concoct to implement free trade and republicanism in Brazil. And so the Portuguese government becomes very worried, of course. They're looking at what just happened to the British government. And so the Portuguese government begins to make concessions to Brazilians in a major way, and particularly concessions in the slave trade between Brazil and Africa. And the Portuguese government assumes that if they can appease Brazilians, that they will strengthen the empire and that they can dissociate trade liberalization from republicanism. And therefore, if trade liberalization is associated with monarchy rather than republicanism, then Brazilians, of course, have no need to revolutionize to enjoy free trade. And by and large, the Portuguese government is successful in its strategy. Brazilians begin to associate the Portuguese monarchy with trade liberalization rather than republicanism. By the 1790s, the Portuguese government had liberalized, as I said, the slave trade between Brazil and Africa, made it easier for Brazilians to acquire slaves from Africa, but it also, to some extent, had given Brazilians one of the things that they most desired, which was some measure of freer trade with Spanish America, in which they could sells slaves to Spanish America and imports Spanish gold from Potosí. They had done that by smuggling for a long time, but now they could do it, without the risks of smuggling because the Portuguese government had liberalized it. And so by the end of the 1790s, Brazilian officials and Brazilian traders are starting to associate monarchy and trade liberalization rather than republicanism and trade liberalization. And so we see Brazil and North America starting to go in two different trajectories in terms of how they viewed free trade and its relationship with political systems.
So continuing that part of the story, how and why did the Portuguese monarchy establish a dynasty in Rio de Janeiro for open ports as the, quote, liberator of commerce? And what were the, quote, liberal advantages for U.S. traders and the consequences of the 1807 embargo for these same traders?
Yeah, so really in 1807 and 1808, we see the scripts flipped in a lot of ways. So you have Portuguese, what happens essentially is Napoleon. In 1807, in late 1807, Napoleon plans an invasion of Portugal. Great Britain and France had sort of tussled over Portuguese loyalties for several years, and the Portuguese tried to carve out some semblance of neutrality. But in the end, Napoleon essentially got tired of waiting for them and decided he was just going to invade Portugal and essentially compel them to submission. And so that throws the Portuguese monarchy unreservedly really into the arms of the British. And the British help the Portuguese monarchy, the entire royal family and the entire court, somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people who in November of 1807 actually load up ships and sail across the Atlantic and move the Portuguese monarchy, the seat of monarchy, to Rio de Janeiro rather than Lisbon. And the thinking is, well, the French may occupy Lisbon, but they won't have conquered the empire. The empire will continue even though the monarchy is now based out of Rio de Janeiro. And so as part of that move, the Prince Regent, who is now reigning on behalf of his mother Maria I, the Prince Regent Dom João VI, essentially is forced to open Brazilian ports to the wider world. Great Britain basically says, well, we can help convey you across the Atlantic and give the monarchy protection against France, but it's going to take concessions, and the concessions are opening Brazil to foreign commerce. And so that's what essentially gets Brazil to open its doors to foreign nations, including the United States. So in a lot of ways, Napoleon did for North American traders what Thomas Jefferson could not do by opening Brazilian ports to them. And so this really, in a lot of ways, culminates the idea among Brazilians that monarchy is not at all opposed to free trade. And in fact, they begin to hail Dom João VI as what they called the liberator of commerce. And so this completely flips on its head the American idea that monarchies are inherently opposed to free trade. And what really flips the script even more is that at the same time, really within a month of the Portuguese landing in Brazil, the U.S. Congress had passed the Embargo Act of 1807 that prohibited trade with foreign nations among Americans. And they did that, of course, to try to assert their sovereignty in the face of threats to their sovereignty by the Portuguese and the British. And the Americans were essentially trying to compel European nations to respect their neutrality and their right to neutral trade with belligerent nations. But what it really did was really throw out this idea that republicans were equated with free trade and monarchies were associated with trade restrictions. Because at the very time you have the Portuguese monarchy opening Brazil, you have the American Republic closing foreign imports, or excuse me, foreign exports. And so this is this creates a real conundrum for American free traders who had always drawn this nice syllogism between republicanism and free trade. And what it really showed in a lot of ways was that that narrative, that myth really, was just never quite as tidy as Americans like to believe. And in fact, what really exposed this even more was that it was, of course, Thomas Jefferson's administration who had called for the embargo, the person who in 1786 had had the first, the first discussions with Brazilian revolutionaries about the possibility of a republic opening in Brazil that would be open to free trade with the United States. So by the time he gets to 1807, Thomas Jefferson has now implemented the very embargo that reduces or that makes trade with Brazil illegal in the United States at the very moment that it became that foreign trade became legal in Brazil.
What happened after the U.S. federal government lifted the 1807 embargo, particularly in regards to U.S. officials and free traders' conceptions of U.S. republicanism, as well as the U.S. provisioning trade and Luso-Atlantic commerce during the Napoleonic Wars that you mentioned?
Yeah, so the embargo itself, as we know it, is lifted by what's called the Non-Intercourse Act of 1809. And in the Non-Intercourse Act, the Congress essentially said, well, you know, we allow trade with anybody who respects our neutral rights. And that, of course, included Brazil. But by that time, the embargo had given the British a strong upper hand in Brazil. And in fact, Henry Hill, who was a U.S. consul in Salvador, in 1808, when the when the Portuguese monarchy came to Rio de Janeiro, Henry Hill was very fulsome in his praise about this move. And he suggested that this is going to open Brazilian ports and it's going to open hopefully a liberal trade relationship between the United States and Brazil. And maybe even so much that we can actually muscle the British out of South America. And that was always a little too optimistic anyway, but certainly when the U.S. government implemented the embargo, it became especially difficult for Americans to, muscle out the British because Americans were prohibited from going to Brazil. And so in the meantime, the British had made quite a strong entrance into the Brazilian trade. And they turned to Brazil to import goods that they could not get from the United States due to the embargo. And so the embargo really only strengthened ties between the British and Brazil rather than opening up any sort of really advantageous trade between the United States and Brazil. And so even after the Non-Intercourse Act opens Brazil once again to U.S. commerce or allows U.S. traders to go to Brazil, they really had no way of competing with the British by that point. The British had made a strong push into Brazil already, and trade with Brazil continued to suffer. And what caused it to suffer even more was that the Napoleonic Wars, time that we now call the Peninsular War, when Napoleon was at war with Spain and also with Portugal now, was really in full swing. So in 1808, the British take back Lisbon from the French, and they begin to with all of these British troops in Portugal, they begin to demand more provisions, and they are getting those provisions in large part from the United States, again from Pennsylvania, New York, and Maryland, who are sending loads of flour and wheat and other breadstuff to Portugal for the British armies that are fighting in Portugal. And so that turns U.S. attention back to Portugal. At the very time, at the very instant that Brazil became open to U.S. Trade, U.S. traders had sort of lost interest in Brazil because the trade in Portugal was so good. Prices were so high because of bread scarcities due to war, due to the influx in troops there. And so they became so high, prices became so high and business so good in Portugal on British military accounts that Americans, a lot of U.S. traders actually began to shed some of their debts to British creditors, and actually U.S. traders in some instances began to become creditors to the British, who were importing copious amounts on the accounts of the British military. And so it was trade, you know, not only had they been really disappointed that, you know, Brazil was not becoming a Republican free trade partner, that they were still, you know, it was a monarchy who was opening trade in Brazil and that wasn't really doing them any good. They were actually enhancing their position to the British due to their trade with Europe, not with the Americas. And they had always conceived of the Western Hemisphere, and Americans had tended to conceive of the Western Hemisphere as a haven, a future haven for republics. And so in all sorts of ways, the scripts are getting flipped, as I say, on Americans who want to associate the Western Hemisphere with republics and republics with free trade and free trade with prosperity, whereas they're now trading more with Portugal than they ever have with Brazil. And they're, you know, in Brazil, they're allowed to trade in Brazil now, but it's with a monarchy rather than a republic. So this really splashes cold water on all of their ideas about republicanism, free trade, and independence.
So please briefly trace the rise and fall of the 1817 insurgency in the Brazilian province of Pernambuco. Please, if you can, also address U.S. promises to insurgents for, quote, absolute liberty of commerce, and the consequences of blockaded insurgent dependency on the U.S. provisioning trade.
Yeah, so when I say that Americans, that U.S. traders really sort of turned away from Brazil and the Brazilian monarchy and started to do a lot of business with Portugal, they really just delayed rather than abandoned their vision of the Western Hemisphere as a series of free trade republics. So after the Napoleonic Wars, after the War of 1812, Americans begin to look again to South America. With the end of the Napoleonic Wars, they're no longer sending their breadstuff, their flour, their wheat into Portugal in the same quantities that they were, and that trade drops off very quickly. And so they again begin to, in terms of their trade with the Portuguese Empire, they again turn their attention toward Brazil, and they still want to believe that Brazil will someday soon become a republic rather than a monarchy that will give the United States preference in their trade. And they start to see, they think they start to see that promise fulfilled in 1817 when a northeastern province in Brazil called Pernambuco begins to revolt against the Portuguese monarchy based in Rio de Janeiro. So in 1817, in March of 1817, Pernambucans begin to revolt. They have new taxes imposed on them by the Portuguese government. That at the same time, they're facing a drought. Things are not looking good in Pernambuco, and they blame a lot of it on the economic control that Rio de Janeiro has on them. And so they begin to revolutionize against the Brazilian government. And so North Americans who observe this start to say, this is it. This is the chance that we have to help Brazil become a republic and to really fulfill its republican destiny, and for us to garner free trade as a result of that. And in some, and Pernambucans fostered that idea. Pernambucan revolutionaries did send envoys to the United States. They were never officially received, but those envoys were promising free trade with the United States, low duties. So Americans begin to look optimistically at Pernambuco. And that was fraught with some tension, though. You do have some Americans who essentially say, look, the monarchy resides in Brazil. Brazil is already independent, and that's what we should worry about. And then others dispute that and say, no, what we need is a republic. It's not enough that Brazil has a monarchy, or that Brazil is independent. It still has a monarchy. We need it to be a republic, and then they'll favor U.S. trade between sister republics. And so a lot of U.S. traders begin to send support, whether moral support or in a lot of ways, financial support, by sending munitions, to Brazilian revolutionaries. And they begin to supply Pernambucan revolutionaries with provisions, and they're selling provisions at just skyrocketing prices in Pernambuco. Like I said, Pernambuco was facing a drought. And so Pernambuco begins to promise Americans everything that they had hoped for with Brazil, a very lucrative trade partner who is committed to independence, complete independence from any European monarchy, and republicanism, who is paying really high prices for American provisions. In the short term, that's really bolstered by this drought that causes Pernambucans to really rely on U.S. provisions. And yet the fact that drought coincided with this revolution gave Americans cause for a lot of optimism, as they're, reaping benefits hand over fist by sending flour and other goods to Pernambucans. And yet the revolution in Pernambuco begins in early March. And by mid-June, it's been quashed. The Portuguese government has gone in. It's blockaded the major Pernambucan port of Recife. And the for all intents and purposes, the revolution is over by June. And so what Pernambuco really represents is simply another false start for to Americans and their quest for trade with Brazil. So they've had several false starts. Thomas Jefferson's false start with Brazilian revolutionaries in the 1780s, the 1807, or the false start that was really quashed, not of course by the Portuguese monarchy, but by the trade embargo, and now the false start of the Pernambucan Rebellion in 1817. And so in a lot of ways, the Pernambucan Rebellion comes to represent the sort of lost promise of Brazil.
Similarly, can you please briefly trace the rise, fall, and aftermath of the 1816 to 1820 Artigas Rebellion in the Banda Oriental? In your very brief narrative, please address one or all of the following: the Neutrality Act of 1817, privateering, diplomacy in what you describe as Atlantic border waters, as well as that racialized criticism, the 1819 Piracy Act, and, if possible, William Redding's, quote, Republican pirates.
Right. So just as things were starting to calm down in Pernambuco, things were just starting to heat up in the south of Brazil, in a region known as the Banda Oriental, which, for all intents and purposes, is basically modern-day Uruguay. And Artigas, José Gervasio Artigas, was a revolutionary strongman in that region who was fighting for a radical form of republicanism, really against Spain. But he's also fighting, once Buenos Aires starts to assume its independence from Spain, José Gervasio Artigas is also fighting against Buenos Aires's centralizing tendencies. He wants the Banda Oriental to maintain its autonomy, not surrender it to Buenos, just surrender it, from Spain to Buenos Aires. And in the midst of this confusion, the Portuguese government had long had its eye on the Banda Oriental. For a long time, the Spanish and Portuguese had had conflicts over the Bando Oriental. It was essentially a borderland between the between Spanish and Portuguese America. And so the Portuguese military invades the Bando Oriental. And so Americans who are observing this view it as another encroachment by a monarchy against republicanism in Brazil. The José Hervásio Artigas was once again promising republicanism, and we see a monarchy, the Portuguese monarchy, stepping in to quash republicanism. Well, as part of his quest for independence and autonomy, José Hervásio Artigas begins to supply commissions to North Americans, to privateer commissions, to prey on Spanish and Portuguese shipping. The problem with these commissions is that José Hervásio Artigas really has no recognition from the international community. So the people who he gives privateer commissions to really inhabit a very shadowy legal space between a privateer and a pirate. And indeed, most people come, including the U.S. government and James Monroe, begin to see them more as pirates than as any sort of legitimate privateer. And yet these a lot of Americans look at these privateers, and this is where we get into William Redding's description of them as Republican pirates. William Redding was a was the editor of the Maryland Censor, and he wrote very glowingly about these Republican pirates who were going down and basically really giving it to the Portuguese monarchy, and helping to fulfill Brazil's quest for republicanism in the face of the failed Pernambucan rebellion. And so these Artigan privateers, though, are going to cause a problem for the U.S. government in that by 1819, the U.S. government has a good chance to secure, to finally secure a commercial treaty with the Portuguese Empire. And that would allow them, hopefully, some good trade advantages in Brazil that might actually help them compete with the British. But the Portuguese government will not treat with the U.S. government until the U.S. government does something about these privateers. And so the U.S. government begins to suppress these pirate slash privateers who are fighting in on behalf of Artigas. And they do that in a couple of ways, and with the Piracy Act of 1819, that makes it more difficult for that, for pirates. It also threatens them with capital punishment if they're caught. And then there's an 1820 Act that essentially bars these privateers, slash pirates. You kind of can use that chain that term interchangeably when discussing these privateers. It bars them from re-landing their vessels or in American ports, in U.S. ports. And so they may be able to outfit a privateer vessel and go down and plunder in South America, but they can't return to the United States once they do that. And so the Piracy Act combined with that act really start to, and also combined with the 1819 financial crisis, economic crisis in the United States, really puts a pinch on these pirates who are sailing in favor of Artigas. So that by 1820, the United States really had quelled privateering in this illegal or illicit privateering in South America. And yet again, it sort of shows this the myth of republicanism in the Western Hemisphere and a free trade ideology, that the United States government suppressed these Artigan privateers, as I call them, or as William Redding called them, these Republican pirates. The U.S. government is suppressing Republican pirates so that it can sign a free trade agreement, or at least an advantageous trade agreement, with the Portuguese monarchy. So we start to see this continual and gradual shift away from this association between republicanism and free trade.
How and why did the socio-political movement to approve the U.S. tariff of 1824, as well as Brazilian acceptance of the transplanted monarchy, reconfigure the U.S. free trade ideology? Further, what was the significance of tumultuous provinces, race, and the slave trade before and after the 1837 Haitian independence movement?
So this is actually an interesting question when we talk about the Tariff of 1824. And in some ways, the Tariff of 1824 doesn't reconfigure the free trade ideology debate. In some ways, it actually reinforces it. When Henry Clay was pushing for tariffs, and Henry Clay and others were pushing for tariffs in the United States, their assumption was, well, we need tariffs on British goods so that we can enhance our manufacturers that we can then hopefully throw into South America, because we'll have free trade with South American republics. So in some ways, the tariff actually reinforces, the Tariff of 1824 paradoxically reinforces the idea that Americans want free trade among among Republicans in the Western Hemisphere. And that really the tariffs are more a means to that end rather than the end itself. And so we see this continuation of free trade ideology and its association with republicanism still, even by the 1820s. And yet in terms of Brazil, that association continues to find to be thwarted, because Brazil, in 1821, the Portuguese court returns to Portugal for a lot of reasons we don't have time to go into. But in 1821, the Portuguese court returns to Lisbon, and that exposes Brazil to rumblings for independence. And Brazilians declare independence in 1822, but it's the monarch's son, Dom Pedro, the Portuguese monarch's son, Dom Pedro, who declares Brazilian independence and institutes a monarchy in Brazil. And so Americans, even once Brazil declares complete independence from Europe, it still retains a monarchy. And so Americans still will not be trading. Even after Brazilian independence, they still won't be trading with a Republican nation in South America, at least in Brazil. And so, again, it's Brazilian independence kind of opens a false promise to Americans. And there's still talk into the 1820s, into the late 1820s, saying, well, we'll kind of take what we can get. At least Brazil is independent, but maybe someday they'll turn into a republic. And what we begin to see, though, with the 1837 Bahian independence movement, is that Americans kind of shrug at it. And the Americans who don't shrug at it are really actually turned off by it. The Bahian independence movement, Bahia is a province toward the northeast of Brazil. And it declares a short-term independence movement in 1837. And yet Americans look at it and they worry that what they're beginning to see is a slave revolt in Bahia, because the Bahian independence movement did wrap a lot of free blacks and slaves into its ranks. And so Americans, who are becoming increasingly sensitive about their own growing slave empire, are really touchy about anything that resembles a slave rebellion, even if it's a Republican slave rebellion. And they begin to look at the Bahian independence movement with skepticism rather than with optimism, and with fear rather than with optimism. And essentially, what we begin to see by the 1830s and continuing into the Civil War is a reorientation of imagining Brazil. For a long time, Americans had wanted to understand Brazil in terms of their nice ideology that equated free trade with republicanism and independence, and monarchy with mercantilism and trade restrictions. And yet, getting toward the end of the Age of Revolution, Americans begin to look at Brazil, after so many false starts, they begin to look at Brazil as a fellow slave power rather than a sister republic.
I have a final question for you, Professor Reeder. What's going on with you next? Are you working on any prospective projects? Is there anything you can disclose to us?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thank you for asking. Actually, the my next project, I'm keeping with U.S. foreign relations, but I am looking at the history of foreign meddling in early American politics from between the 1780s and the Monroe Doctrine. I'll give one spoiler alert. It wasn't the Russians back then.
Excellent. We hope you remember the New Books Network for that project.
Yeah, thank you.
So the book is Smugglers, Pirates, and Patriots, Free Trade in the Age of Revolution by Tyson Reeder, out earlier this year by Penn Press. Professor Reeder, thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. Thanks for having me.